Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Phil Carter from Animal Protection New Mexico about cougars and bears. I'm delighted to welcome now to the program Lexi Shabell. She's a documentary filmmaker. She's the founder of the Breast Wishes Fund, and there's going to be an event on Saturday, the 9th of October at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe, and it's called the Breast Wishes Fundraiser. Welcome, Lexi, to the Radio Cafe.
It's very good to be here. Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So it's about the five-year anniversary of your diagnosis with breast cancer and the beginning of a long journey of healing and treatment and just dealing with this illness. You decided at the very beginning that you wanted to document it.
Mm-hmm. From day one.
I guess if you're a documentary filmmaker, that's just what you do.
I think there's a lot of feelings about how to come from being a victim to a place of empowerment, which has become one of the submission statements of the Breast Wishes Fund, is to make decisions from a place of empowerment versus fear. And I think that was the only way I knew I could get my documentary filmmaker head on and be challenged and excited almost by this disease, you know, that had, I was the fourth generation on my father's side to be diagnosed. To me, it was like, this needs to stop with me. Whatever has happened in the past hasn't been effective. And whether it's DNA or my feeling was when I was diagnosed that it was 50% emotional. When I would touch my tumor, when I would think about my father, it hurt. So I was like, okay, that's really emotionally linked for me. And therefore, you know, but what I was told when I was first diagnosed was that I should have a double mastectomy, even though cancer was only found in one breast, have the other removed as prophylactic, given my family history, have a hysterectomy, even though my cancer was hormone negative, have chemo, have radiation. What I did choose to do was I did some of the chemo and a million other things.
But you didn't have any surgery.
I chose to not have surgery or radiation, and I chose to do so many other paths. And you know, I think a lot of what I really want to preface this conversation with is these are the methods that I've chosen, and the Breast Wishes Fund. We improve access to integrative breast cancer treatment, though. Really, the bottom line, whenever anybody talks to me, all I say is, you know, can you go someplace for an hour? Can you go someplace for a week where you can get your head on after a diagnosis and just make a decision that feels right to you?
Yeah.
And it's about that place of not being so put into a petrified place of fear. And I went back east when I was first diagnosed, and I had a film crew come back for that first week. Michael Meyrendorf, who used to live here and is an incredible award-winning filmmaker, and Diana Taylor, who is also Academy Award-winning filmmaker, who's a local, they documented my first few days, as did Liza Bambanek, who is also a local filmmaker. And
with your family?
With my family in New Jersey, with my father not wanting to have anything to do with this film, or really with me at that point. We had stopped talking. So to me, it was so important to go back to my hometown where I could really meet the story I had created, my own history, and what was real, and what I had, you know, been here for maybe 14 or 11 years at that point and decided was my history.
And there was a distinction.
Absolutely. I'm a storyteller, and I seem to weave my own stories as much as I needed them to be what my history was. Isn't Bob Dylan, you know, always tell like some totally false story about who he was when he was growing up?
Right.
You know? Not to say I am anything like Bob Dylan. I am not drawing that distinction. But, you know, I think people just, after a while, you just...
And so part of, I mean, we're going to see on this event on October 9th at the CCA, one of the things that we get to do is see your film the work in progress. Are you really calling it the me film?
I really am calling it the me film. It's the only thing that stuck with me from day one of the work. Yes. So right now it is a 15-minute work in progress, and it has that first week of kind of hysteria where I'm being followed around by an incredible film crew in my parents' house and seeing all my childhood friends, and then it's a three-act kind of film, a birth, death, kind of rebirth. And part of, I guess, my thesis statement with it is, like, from the time I was born, was I destined to carry on this wound, whatever this wound might be? Because my aunt had it, my grandmother had it, and my great-grandmother, everybody died from breast cancer. And my aunt was alive for part of this, so I did get to interview her when I was doing some of the chemo, and that I'm bummed that I didn't get another interview with her and get to see her again. We did talk, but it was revelatory in terms of some of the things when I'm really exploring myself of what we shared.
I think part of the problem or part of the challenge is, I mean, so many women have breast cancer, die of it, are disfigured from it. How do you walk that path with, as you say, empowerment instead of fear? I mean, we see in this, I mean, I saw the work in progress of your film. You're scared. Anybody would be scared.
Petrified. That first week of diagnosis is just the first month. You know, that was why I chose to do the chemo, because I felt like it bought me some time to get my head back on straight. And that took a few months, to be honest, to really come to a place. I mean, one of the things I say from the very beginning is, I made this cancer. I'm the one who's going to make this cancer go away. That's how I felt from day one. But once you are in doctor's office, oncologists, surgeons, and I mean, I went back to people who had like the best reputations on the East Coast. You know, my family thought that important. So these are people who have incredible reputations, and you get really daunted by, am I going to die? And I was 38 years old when I was diagnosed, and it felt pretty early for me to be questioning this. But I think that became one of the first practices, was a Tibetan Buddhist death practice. And to start really looking at it like a documentary filmmaker, reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead is fascinating. Like, how do they know to break it up into these realms and to go towards the bright light and stay away from that fainter light, you know what I mean? And I've taken lots of classes and teachings at this point, and actually on October 6th, which is a Wednesday, which is my official 5-year diagnosis date at Patrick Smith Park up on Canyon Road in Alameda, we're doing a shave for cancer, where I'm going to shave my head in honor of my 5-year diagnosis date and in solidarity to people living with cancer, regardless of your treatment path. And one of the spiritual leaders who I did take teachings from is Thukhu Sanag Rinpoche, and he's a Tibetan Buddhist teacher who's taught a lot about impermanence and dying, essentially. So I think that is one of the first things that allows so much fear to dissipate once you can feel more comfortable about living or dying. And I went to India last winter for spiritual pilgrimage and health reasons. I did Panchakarma, which is a Ayurvedic detox treatment. And we will have a woman speaking about Ayurveda at the free integrative medicine educational forum at CCA on October 9th. And that being in Varanasi, where they have the burning ghats and people come there and it is supposedly holy to die, I needed that. I had done that myself with my dog when she passed.
I remember that.
Yeah, you came. You came to the burning.
And it was so weird. I brought a friend from the East Coast who was a stockbroker, and he was not emotionally ready for this.
Welcome to Santa Fe. People burning their dogs in the yard. It smells like barbecue.
It smelled like a burning futon, which is what it was.
So I needed to experience that, you know, in India, and especially in a city like Varanasi, life and death are completely intertwined. And to see death as part of your everyday, that felt really healthy to me. That felt really integrated versus everybody like closing their eyes and being like, no, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen to me. And, you know, and
yeah.
And I think a lot of us want to live as healthfully as we can in this body for as long as we can. But for me, that was really like a turning point of coming to terms with what is the worst thing that can happen. And anytime I feel fear in my body, like I make myself sit with it now, and I'm like, what am I really afraid of? What am I really afraid of right now?
And what are you really afraid of right now?
I think lately it's been dying alone without like the love of my life being there. That has been something that I think I went through a crisis a few weeks ago because I have been working with the cancer. It seems, and what's interesting in being a documentary filmmaker is that I have been able to document the cycles of my cancer growth and times where it's dormant. Keeping that tumor has become a conscience for me. It's become a really interesting part of my life and one of those things that forces me to wake up and say, you're not taking care of yourself. You're not living your truth.
You've made a decision that I dare say I don't think I would have made, and that many people under the care of your average, you know, good doctor would not have made, which is that having determined that the cancer had not spread outside of your breast, you still chose not to have a surgery to cut the lump out, and you've been living with this for 5 years. You're in fabulous health. How did you make that choice not to have surgery, and then the subsequent choices of what treatments to take?
That's an interesting question. I think I keep waiting for somebody to tell me, and I do speak with the surgeon once a year, you know, and I go get an ultrasound. Ultrasound is the method that I use to kind of monitor what's going on with me. So that's why I say I am living an integrative path. I am still somewhere in the hospital-based world, though not like I was. What inspired me to not have the surgery ultimately was that the tumor completely disappeared and there was absolutely no trace of it on any type of testing. And then I read an article by Dr. Harriet Beanfield, and at the Gringa Productions, Gringa with an A, Productions with an S, gringaproductions.com, there is a treatment diary blog, and there are links for integrative medicine research, all kinds of things that I've done or have been intrigued by. And one of those is the history of breast cancer surgery. And it's a two-part series by Dr. Harriet Beanfield, who describes, I think it was not much more than 100 years ago, where they were removing the entire rib cage to remove a breast cancer. And it confirmed something in me, which is, this is overkill. And I think what I also felt from day one is, this cancer for me is systemic. It is manifesting in this tumor in my breast. But it is all through my body. The thought that had it spread to my lymph nodes or not, to me was ludicrous. Of course it's in my lymph system. It's in my blood. It's in my body. I have cancer cells. What I work with now is, how do I kill off the cancer cells as quickly and efficiently as possible? And how do I get them out of my body as quickly as possible? And that's where detoxification comes in, alkalizing my body, all kinds of things that, you know, are commonplace here in Santa Fe in terms of detoxification.
Right.
I think that aspect has... I do not say that I will never have surgery at this point. I don't say that. But the more people I talk to that I have amazing respect for, and the Breast Wishes Fund has been incredible for, and this fundraiser has been incredible for reaching out to a public and people sharing their experiences of decades with me and their thoughts on this, in that it manifests where it manifests, but that until I can figure it out with the whole body, my physically, emotionally, everything, I will always have cancer. And the tumor at this point is a reminder. It's become a, like in Hinduism, there's Kali, you know, who is the creator and destroyer. And she's very, very daunting, very scary goddess in some ways. But in other ways, she cuts through truth. She tells you the truth. And for me, that's my path. My path is, I don't want my niece to have to deal with breast cancer. I want to figure some stuff out. And so whether it's the physical treatments that I'm doing or the emotional treatments, I'm documenting these. There's something we're working on called the Guinea Pig Flicks, which will be super saturating the internet to show me as the guinea pig receiving different treatments, anywhere from somatic experiencing, psychotherapy, to a colonic. You know, these things that people don't want to mention, but to be honest, they're huge as we get older and our bodies become toxic, you know, and our minds, or we carry around trauma.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. When you so the tumor was completely gone, and then it came back, and you're kind of working with it. What is the relationship that you've been able to really see between your emotional life and your way of life and your cancer?
I find that when I am not walking my truth, when I am not taking care of myself physically, that my threshold is much lower, I think, than the average person.
So like eating Doritos and not getting enough sleep, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. Unfortunately for me, I feel like if I can do that for periods of time now. I was incredibly disciplined and strict in the beginning, and I can do it for periods of time, but when I fall into a habit of I guess pretending I'm a normal person, and that's probably been one of the hardest things, is I have chosen this path, or this path has chosen me, and I'm not normal. And I can't pretend, not to say I'm better than anybody, absolutely not that, but I can't live on McDonald's. I can't live on things. I was a photographer for 10 years. I mean, some of the detox I'm doing, I started smelling Dectol, which is the developer. You know,
Are you serious?
Yeah, and some of the detoxification, I start smelling
things. So you think that stuff is stored in your fat or whatever?
Absolutely.
And it comes out?
I had chronic fatigue, as it's called, and fibromyalgia for years before I was diagnosed with cancer. To me, the immune system and everything I experienced, and like the misery I was in with that, is completely related. I was overloaded with infection. My immune system is compromised. I used to be a camera woman for reality shows. I had a gig around the world, and I got a bunch of immunizations. And after that, my health went so, I had a cold every other week, and, you know, talking to other people, it's like I had heavy metal poisoning, all these things. I mean, it's our environment is so difficult to navigate at this point, from EMFs, and I think some people are more sensitive to it. I think some people, what was explained to me once, is some people are receptors and some people are conductors. Electricity goes through some people and just comes out the other side, and other people get stuck and you're buzzing. I'm one of those people, like, I'm in New York City, I am buzzing, you know, and I didn't get to choose to be this person. It would be easier and probably more fun to just be really hyper insensitive and just be able to do whatever I want whenever I want. But
you're in Santa Fe.
It's true, and I feel like in my 20s I led a very rock and roll lifestyle. And one of my kind of homages to rock and roll is a film we're going to show at 10 o'clock for donation at CCA called We Like to Drink, We Like to Play Rock and Roll, and I was diagnosed 3 days after making this film. And when I was making this film, I knew it was the wrong film to be making for me personally, but I had started it. All my films seemed to take about 6 years to finish.
And it's great. It showed at the Santa Fe Film Festival years ago, and that was the first time that we ever did an interview on this program.
Oh, really?
And it's a very good movie. We're talking to Lexi Chabel, and it's the Breast Wishes fundraiser at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe on Saturday, the 9th of October. Now, from noon to 5, there is an integrative cancer educational forum, all kinds of demos. It's free, open to the public. There's, of course, a suggested donation for various events during the day if people want to. But what are you going to be doing at this educational forum?
And just to preface, it's not just cancer. It's really, I mean, one of the mission statement of the Breast Wishes Fund is to improve access to breast cancer treatment and wellness to women of all ages. What we really want to do is get young women involved to just look at their lifestyle from day one. Look at the things to start avoiding, estrogen, you know, all the negative estrogens, whatever it is, to deal with their emotional state. If you're a 19-year-old girl and you've been raped, you know, what are the chances that you have of integrating and digesting that experience from an early age with the proper care and living a more fruitful life than waiting till you're 45 years old and you have a breakdown? To me, it's like a lot of it starts with young women, and that is a lot of our... So a lot of it is about wellness and care. So we're having... at noon, I'm going to give my inexpensive personal cancer protocol And each speaker will speak for a half hour. There'll be 15 minutes of Q&A. Then there'll be 15 minutes to just hang out. We're going to have food for sale. We're having a silent auction. When amazing art. You know, Melanie West just dropped off a photograph. We have Jennifer Esperanza, Grant Hyunga, Justin Roberts Gallery. Many people are donating some really fine, fine pieces. And we're also having Yogita Wengats, who she is with the UNM Center for Life and also the Ayurvedic Institute. She's going to talk about Ayurveda and women's health. We are going to have Margot Covington talk about lymphatic release, which has been really key. The lymph system was never even mentioned to me when I was diagnosed. And also Sorrel Page, who's been giving colonics here in Santa Fe for decades. She's going to come and demystify what a colonic is, which I have to say, when you're detoxing, it's a huge, inexpensive element to wellness, is your digestion. And also Dr. Pam Burnham is going to talk about somatic experience in psychotherapy, which is incredible at dealing at digesting trauma. So for me, it was pivotal in terms of digesting the chemo experience and the hospital and the trauma of diagnosis, which of course spun off into like something that happened, you know, when I was 10. But it allowed, I mean, I couldn't even go to a dentist without freaking out and being traumatized for a week afterwards after the whole chemo experience. So she really helped me, and she went down to like Katrina. And she does something called, she teaches a class called Trauma First Aid, and she's just, she has such a combination of experiences. And then,
and all of these things, as you talk about them, are things that a lot of people do in a preventive way who don't want to get major illnesses when they're older.
It's for wellness or it's for treatment. I mean, yeah. Either or, I think all of these have benefit in every person's life. And they're simple, and they're inexpensive.
And you've put a lot of these things together for yourself, mm-hmm. as a lot of people have, and I imagine that there's a lot of need for people who are all reinventing the wheel in their separate little houses to get together and compare notes.
Yeah, yeah. It's and one door opens another door. Just working on this, people have been sharing amazing stories. And that was one of the reasons I, for the head shaving event on October 6th at Patrick Smith Park, I'm inviting people to just share their cancer stories, because I just felt like this isn't right. People should be sharing this with each other, not just with me. Just going around asking for donations in Santa Fe, which I have to thank this town. It's been an incredible town to really live the Buddhist principle of the begging bowl. People have been so generous and open about their experiences.
So at 6 o'clock on Saturday, October 9th, there will be a screening of your film, House of Rock. And then from 7 to 10, there will be all sorts of things, music, poetry, and a screening of your work in progress, which at this point is, what, 15 or 20 minutes long?
It's 15 minutes. It's called The Me Film.
The Me Film is about this whole everything we've been talking about today.
Exactly. Although I have to say it's not an instructional documentary. My work is very character-driven, and its primary focus really is entertainment. And the Breast Wishes Fund was created as community outreach around the film, because I didn't want to have to pack a bunch of information. I think ultimately it will be marketed where the DVD will have lots of information. But the Breast Wishes Fund was really to disseminate the information. And we're going to have a DJ dance party from 9 to 11:30 with DJ Spinifex. And meanwhile, we're going to be doing a live body paint, where you can come in and make your own beautiful body paint project. And we're having the Painted Ladies, which is this incredible improv actress group that's going to, their color is now red, and they'll paint their bodies red, and I'm not really sure exactly what they're going to do. And we're going to have Lorianne Ferrantino is going to deliver some powerful songs, and yeah, I think it's going to be, and at 10 o'clock We Like to Drink is going to play, so we're just going
to
really...
We Like to Drink, We Like to Play Rock and Roll.
You got it.
I just think it's a really hilarious and great band, rock band on tour movie.
Yeah, thank you. It's kind of a nonfiction Spinal Tap. And
right.
And we're having Q&As with, you know, after the Me Film work in progress. I mean, it's going to just be kind of from noon to midnight. Just come by at some point. I mean, just stop by, say hi, see what we're doing in that moment. And I'm just very excited after working on events for other people for so long. And to work on something that I feel so great about, and I know it's going to be fun and informative and create dialogue and community and just all the things that are important to me. And be titillating, too. I mean, you know,
no pun intended.
We have great food donations. You know, Walter Burke, head chef there, she's making titty cakes, which are going to be little breast cupcakes. And, you know, everybody's just been really generous. So there'll be lots of fun and good things to eat and drink, too.
Lexi Schaebel is a documentary filmmaker, founder of the Breast Wishes Fund. Once again, the Breast Wishes fundraiser is Saturday, the 9th of October at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. And the website, if anybody would like more information, is gringaproductions.com, G-R-I-N-G-A, gringaproductions.com. Lexi, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome Phil Carter. He is Wildlife Campaign Manager for Animal Protection of New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me on.
So we are here to talk about some new rules that are being proposed by the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish, which would affect bear and cougar populations and the rules about hunting them here in New Mexico. Let's talk about the situation of these animals in our wildlands of New Mexico today. Where do they live? What are we talking about? Where do cougars and bears live in the state of New Mexico?
Well, for cougars, we're referring to the animals also called mountain lions, pumas, and catamounts.
That's all the same thing?
That's all the same animal. The Department of Game and Fish uses the word cougar for their management, so that's how I'll refer to them. And for black bear, it's all black bears in New Mexico, and so when I say bears, it'll be black bears is what I'm referring to. Where cougars live is generally anywhere that's mountainous and at all wild in New Mexico. Pretty much anywhere that's mountainous will probably have a few cougars in it. As far as bears, they're a little more spread out, but generally the same, you know, forested areas, mountainous areas is where you'll find black bears.
What do each of these animals eat, and what kind of living conditions and habitats do they need in order to survive and thrive?
Well, cougars are purely carnivorous. They eat only meat.
They're cats,
essentially. Black bears have an omnivorous diet, so they eat everything from berries to small animals, essentially. Only 10% of their diet comes from animal protein. It's mostly vegetable material that black bears eat.
And so what kind of prey do cougars hunt?
Generally deer, sometimes elk, sometimes antelope, or bighorn sheep.
So it's like watching National Geographic.
Essentially, yeah. They tend to be stalking type hunters as far as they sneak up on their prey and attack by closing off the windpipe of deer or elk.
Now, do they keep those populations healthy by weeding out the weak animals and all that kind of thing?
Absolutely. We refer to cougars as a keystone species because they affect other animal populations and kind of regulate them through their hunting. They essentially make deer and elk and antelope populations stronger by weeding out the sick and young and old and overall increasing the genetic robustness of deer and elk populations.
I think it's really notable how different their style of hunting is from what humans do when they hunt the same animals. When humans hunt deer and elk, they don't weed out the weakest and oldest members of the population.
That's absolutely why cougars are so important to ecosystem health, is by regulating prey species like deer and elk and making more genetic robustness, they keep those populations healthy, whereas hunters tend to go for trophies, i.e. the strongest and fastest of deer and elk populations. So hunting is not much of a substitute for natural predation by animals like cougars.
So to what extent are these populations here in New Mexico scientifically studied and understood? I mean, do we know in different parts of the state how many cougars and how many bears and so on that we have?
Yeah, we have a pretty good idea based on the studies that have been done here. In the case of cougars, we have what's considered the Bible of cougar studies. It's a study by Ken Logan and Linda Swainer called Desert Puma. It was completed in 2001. This is a 10-year comprehensive study conducted here in New Mexico to draw population totals, habitat analysis, and many, many aspects of cougar populations. As far as bears, we also have a similar study also conducted in 2001 that our management policies are based off of.
And so what are the new rules and regulations that are being proposed, and why? What problems are they trying to address?
Well, the new proposals were initially introduced by the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish in late July, in keeping with their mandate of a 30-day deadline before the August 28th Game Commission meeting, in which they'd be introducing these proposals. After the Game Commission meeting, there was there was a significant amount of outcry for just the radical increases in bear and cougar hunting that was proposed by the department. So they went back and revised them a little, and the latest and final proposals for bear and cougar hunting came out just this last Friday, September 24th. What they call for is a 103% increase in all cougar, what they call sport harvest level. Basically, that's the amount of hunting. 103% increase in all cougar hunting. And for females, it's 196% increase from the levels they're currently at. And I can get into later why the levels for female hunting are so important. On bears, they're calling for an 80% increase in overall bear mortality, with a 96% increase in female bear hunting.
So why such a huge increase in bear and cougar hunting? What are they trying to solve, or are they just trying to meet the demand for hunting? You know, are hunters pressuring them? What's going on?
Well, essentially, the department for this latest round of proposals included their rationale, which was helpful. I wish they had included that in the initial proposals for both decision makers and the public. For cougars, they listed these hunting quotas as a response to considerations of human safety, depredation, nuisance, and protection of bighorn sheep. And I'll go into why the science really does not support hunting as a response to those issues. Similarly, bear issues are bear hunting is in response to depredation and nuisance issues.
What is depredation?
Depredation is essentially anything killed by a bear or cougar, whether it's an animal or a domestic or wild.
And so, but that's what cougars do.
Is exactly.
And so, is the idea that there's too many elks and deers and stuff being killed?
Certainly, the department has made that case in their latest, population estimates and hunting quotas. Whether the science really supports that is another matter. Whether hunting bears and cougars really affects overall populations of deer, elk, and other ungulates.
So let's talk about that. First of all, what is the problem? You just talked about bighorn sheep. Are bighorn sheep a population of wild animal that needs to be protected at this point?
Yes, the Department of Game and Fish has looked to protect the bighorn populations. The problem with approaching it from an angle of killing more cougars will confer to better bighorn sheep populations is the science simply doesn't support it.
Uh-huh.
In Cougar Management Guidelines, Cougar Management Guidelines is a summary study published in 2005 by 11 leading cougar biologists as a way of giving management advice for state agencies. They demonstrate that sport hunting to benefit wild ungulate populations is not supported by the scientific literature, period. So basically, killing more cougars will not confer to larger or better bighorn populations.
Why not? I mean, if cougars prey on them.
Basically, reducing cougar numbers through sports hunting just simply doesn't work for the reasons I outlined before. By reducing the amount of carnivores in the population that hunt bighorn populations, you essentially destabilize the ecosystem, leading to overpopulation of things like bighorn sheep with weaker individuals and less genetic robustness. It simply is just not a management tool.
Huh. And so if that reason is not supported by science, is there a whole world of human cougar hunters that are just itching to get out there and shoot them?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is definitely a community of cougar hunters out there. As far as speculating on why the Department of Game and Fish is putting forth these radical increases in cougar hunts, I don't think it's really worthwhile to speculate so much as because that just simply turns cougars into a political football and doesn't really help in my or anybody's advocacy of them. What we need to do is count on the Department of Game and Fish to use the best available science in their proposals, which is simply something they have not done for reasons I can get into. Basically, what the Department of Game and Fish has outlined in its latest proposals is to both stabilize and decrease cougar populations through radical increases in hunting. For stability of populations, they've recommended a 25% increase in hunting with 30% increase in female hunting.
How can you tell when you're hunting whether it's a male or a female?
Well, that's a proposal we're looking to the New Mexico Game Commission to mandate at their final meeting on October 28th, where they'll make the final decision on these. Basically better hunter education and mandatory hunter education if they want to get a cougar permit is necessary.
So you can, if you have proper hunter education, you can mm-hmm. tell whether you're hunting a female or male cougar?
We can certainly reduce the risk of people hunting females and thereby, you know, destabilizing cougar populations and leave a bunch of cougar kittens orphaned in that way. We can reduce the risk. But as far as getting back to in decreasing, the Game and Fish Department is also looking to decrease certain cougar populations through a 30% harvest rate, harvest meaning hunting, in these areas with a 50% harvest rate for female cougars. This, unfortunately, is not really...
Meaning hunters get to kill 50% of the existing cougars in the wild?
Existing female cougars. Yes. Yes.
That's
enormous, and again, it's the real problem with hunting females is that the hunting season begins on October 1st and runs through April 1st, and so cougar mothers drop their litters in summer, and so by the time the hunting season starts in October, these kittens are still very young and still back in the den, dependent on their mother to bring back prey for them. And so the timing is really bad for these kittens, because kittens don't reach maturity until between 10 months and 2 years of age. And so they're basically, by increasing female hunting, we're going to leave a lot of orphaned kittens and a lot of juveniles that don't have as much experience. And going further with that, the problem with having a lot of juveniles in your population is basically it destabilizes the natural regulation that cougars have for themselves. As the literature says, hunting may shift cougar population structure towards younger animals, which are more likely than adult cougars to attack humans. So
it's just like people. The younger ones are more likely to attack.
Yeah, essentially, by having a younger population, you decrease human safety in cougar habitat.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean...
So you go kill a lot of mature cougar mothers, And you're creating the problem that you're part of the problem that you're trying to solve.
Exactly.
And namely, attacks on humans.
And amazingly, I just cited from a study on the issue of destabilizing cougar populations from a study called Bayer 1991. This is actually a study that was referenced in the Cougar Population Assessment and Harvest Management Matrix by the Department of Game and Fish. Same study, yet they somehow got the implication that they should increase cougar hunting, even though the science points to that will actually make humans less safe.
So we're talking to Phil Carter of Animal Protection New Mexico. Let's get back to the bighorn sheep issue. If you want to protect bighorn sheep and cougar hunting is not the way to, I mean, increasing cougar hunting isn't the way to do it, what is the way to do it?
If you want to make the bighorn sheep population better, you basically got to have to approach it with the best available science, which demonstrates that cougars are necessary to maintain ecosystem balance and thereby understanding that we have to keep a certain baseline level of these cougar predators in the wild.
But I mean, is there anything else you can do to protect the bighorn sheep? Okay, so the old and weak ones get weeded out, but are there any other protections for these sheep?
Well, certainly good scientific management of the bighorn sheep populations themselves through, you know, responsible hunting, which is a separate issue, besides cougar management.
Oh, these animals get hunted. You can get permits to hunt those things,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, you can purchase permits to hunt bighorn sheep.
So given, and tell me if I'm wrong on this, but given that cougar populations have to be managed in the first place, now are we talking about public land and only public land? We're talking about wildlife areas?
No, this is... basically, the management is done by what the department calls game management unit areas that encompass, public and private land. Essentially,
okay.
It's the map of New Mexico is broken up into game management units.
And so, given that populations of wild animals do need to be managed, and you can tell me if that's correct or incorrect, what, according to the science that you've got your hands on and that these cougar biologists that you were talking about have done, what is the proper management of cougars in New Mexico?
Well, at this point, the best available science is this study I mentioned earlier, Logan and Sweener 2001. This was a New Mexico taxpayer-funded study over 10 years in New Mexico. Taxpayers paid about $1 million to have this done in conjunction with the Game and Fish Department. At this point, this is the best available science we have, and it recommends an 11% harvest rate of cougars in order to maintain stable populations. Where the numbers are at currently, 490 cougars harvested per year is very close to that 11% rate.
So basically, the regulations that now exist in terms of the Department of Game and Fish handing out permits to hunters is already correct?
Is already correct according to the best available science
right.
we have.
And so so what you're saying is that proposed rules are changing good existing regulations for the worse.
Certainly, justifiable regulations. What the department is proposing to do is radically increase cougar hunting in New Mexico based on a new population assessment they've conducted using two sources. One of which is a model designed by the department and Dr. Travis Perry, Ph.D. The other one is a master's thesis by Travis Perry's student, Megan Pittman. Both of these studies have never been published nor peer-reviewed. And I'm not a scientist, and nor are the vast majority of the public stakeholders in wildlife management. So we look to outside qualifiers like peer review to have confidence that the Game and Fish Department really is managing wisely according to the best available science.
Have you seen these studies?
No. I and some of my colleagues in Wild Earth Guardians and Sierra Club did an Inspection of Public Records Act request in late August to see several documents, including this master's thesis. The Department of Game and Fish informed me they couldn't share that with me because they themselves do not possess a copy of the master's thesis where they got their population estimate. And so I'm left to assume that the department is basing its population estimates on a study that they don't even have, and nor has the New Mexico Game Commission, which will make the final decision on these management proposals. They haven't seen the study either.
Wait. So the new regulations are based on a study that isn't peer-reviewed and that none of the people who are making the new regulations have seen?
Well, they told me that the department does not have a copy.
They don't have a copy of it.
Of it. And so, nor has it ever been published. The best they could do for me was a contact for this master's student who I haven't heard back from.
Now, why is all of this important to our listeners?
Basically, you know, all of your listeners are public stakeholders in wildlife management. And as New Mexicans, both cougars and bears are part of our Western heritage. And the majority of New Mexicans want to see these wild creatures in the wild spaces of New Mexico, both for ecosystem health and just overall enjoyment of our wild lands. And, you know, to reduce the slight risk of cougar encounters by humans, my organization, Animal Protection in New Mexico, has collaborated on an educational program called Cougar Smart with several land management agencies. And these are educational materials like posters and little tags for children on tips for safe and responsible conduct in cougar country. And if anybody would like to receive some of those educational materials, you can email me at phil@apnm.org.
APNM standing for Animal Protection New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So how many cases or what kind of danger or risk of being attacked by a cougar or a bear do we really have? I mean, are there a lot of attacks in New Mexico?
No, I mean, the cougar attacks are and always have been extremely rare. There's only been about 18 mortalities from cougars in the last century for the entire United States.
That's not a lot.
It's extremely
small. And in those 18 cases in 100 years all over the United States, do you think that they were things that could have been prevented if people had taken proper precautions being out in the wild?
Certainly there's very
easy. Were they like leaving food in their tent and that, you know?
I couldn't say. I mean, I couldn't say on each case specific basis, but certainly there are just very simple tips on reducing any sort of risk, including don't walk at dusk or dawn when cougars are out hunting, always keep small children within arm's length, just real basic stuff that, you know, anybody looking to be safe in the wild should undertake, or really any environment.
I went to Alaska once many years ago, and I was on Kodiak, and there were just bear safety flyers all over the place. It was just bear safety was part of life. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that when that's part of your culture, you practice it.
Absolutely. No, and I mean, people have to understand that, you know, the risk is extremely small, but it is there. I mean, the only way to reduce risk 100% is complete extermination of cougars and bears. And so, I mean, that's the most extreme wildlife management style there is. And
but
so
that has other that has unhappy consequences.
Unhappy consequences. And the majority of New Mexicans know we have to mitigate a slight human safety risk. And again, the available science shows that sport hunting is not the way to do it. It actually increases safety risk for humans.
So if people want to get involved and have their voice heard before any final decision is made about bear and cougar hunting, what should they do?
Well, basically, at this point, please contact the New Mexico Game Commission. The Game Commission is an independently appointed body that has final say on wildlife management in New Mexico. They were actually supposed to have their final rulemaking decision meeting September 28th, but postponed it due to the huge volume of public outcry against these dramatic increases in bear and cougar hunting, which I commend the Game Commission for doing because it's an unusual step. Their final decision-making meeting will be on October 28th in Ruidoso. You can find contact information for all the game commissioners on New Mexico Department of Game and Fish's website and also on our website, apnm.org. Please contact them, say why you do not support the bear and cougar rule change. You want it to revert back to the status quo, which actually is justifiable by the best available science. And you would like, you know, increased focus on scientific management of both bears and cougars in New Mexico. Please get those comments in before October 28th, and if you can make it down to Ruidoso for the next game and game commission meeting, please do so.
Does it help when people show up in person?
Absolutely. You know, public testimony is the most effective, you know,
more
public
so
comment.
Than writing those letters?
Well, yeah. I mean, there certainly presence there means you're very interested in you know, how these management goals work. But, I mean, do both and tell your friends and family to contact the Game Commission.
Phil Carter is Wildlife Campaign Manager for Animal Protection of New Mexico. You can find them on the web at apnm.org, and Phil's email is phil, P-H-I-L, at apnm.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news, and after that, jazz.